Just so you know, this show is about scary stuff. So don't say I didn't warn you guys. And remember, don't be scared.
Murderous Minors brings true tales of children who have killed. Premeditated murders, accidental killings and deaths. From toddlers to 18-year-old killers, no one is too young to take a life. Join me, War Baby, as I try to tell these stories of the young who've killed, the lives they took, and even the ones who've been left behind. Why do children kill? What do we do with young killers? And do they kill again? Until next time, don't be scared.
Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. Kelly Bordeaux was a young soldier at North Carolina's Fort Bragg. One night, in 2012, she took a break from her regimented lifestyle to enjoy a Friday night at a local bar where she had a few drinks, played a couple of games of pool, and belted out some songs on karaoke. However, after leaving the bar that night, Kelly vanished, but not before sending a text message saying that she had arrived home safely. Rumors would circulate about an out-of-state husband and a homeless sex offender. But what really happened to Kelly? And was that last text message really from her? Kelly Bordeaux was a private first class in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. She was a native of St. Cloud, Florida, but in July of 2011, she joined the military and was assigned to the 44th Medical Brigade and had been working as a health service specialist. She lived with her husband, Mike Bordeaux, in an apartment off Ramsey Street, a quiet neighborhood nestled among pine trees. The area had seen a large growth over the years, primarily due to the influx of military personnel. The couple had been married for just over 2 years, and Kelly had ambitions to one day become an officer. She was friendly, bubbly, and easy to get along with.
Like I said, she was a United States soldier.
She was very proud of that. She was a very determined young woman. She wasn't just a nobody. She wasn't just some girl. She was my youngest child. She was my baby.
As her brother, Matt Henson, said, Kelly wanted to excel in life. That was her thing. She was smart, she was funny, she was beautiful. According to Mike, despite the fact that Kelly stood at only 5 feet tall, she could take care of herself. He said that from her standpoint, she was never worried, but as her husband, he always worried about her. Mike also worked on Fort Bragg, but in construction for a civilian company. The couple would go to work within an hour of each other and then get off around the same time. They both enjoyed cooking dinner together and then watching Netflix or playing video games, especially Call of Duty. Mike often joked that Kelly was even better at the game than he was. On the 16th of April, 2012, Kelly was reported missing by Fort Bragg officials when she failed to report for duty. Her colleague, Marcia Michael, knew immediately that something was wrong. Kelly was never late for duty. She had been sent to Kelly's apartment to see if maybe she had slept in, but when she arrived, she found that Kelly was not there. Kelly's family were quick to say that this was completely out of character for Kelly, who was extremely punctual. Her sister, Olivia Cox, said that Kelly wanted to make sure that she had a successful future and said that she would not jeopardize that by randomly missing work and not informing anybody where she was. As is routine, when somebody goes missing, their partner is often the very first suspect. At the time, however, Mike was in Florida with his father, and his alibi was airtight.
I was actually in Kissimmee, Florida. I was staying at my dad's house. I was out visiting them, my dad and my stepmom, for a little while. And I got the phone call Monday around 11:30 from my apartment manager, and Kelly's lieutenant was here, and they were wondering why or if I knew where Kelly was. And I said, no, you know, she should be at work. And, you know, I'm thinking it's 11:30, so why isn't she showing up to work? So, you know, they asked me if they can go in the apartment. I said, for sure, you have my approval to go into the apartment and check and see if she's okay. You know, maybe she missed her alarm or something and wasn't, you know. So I just let them walk in the house, and they said that she wasn't there. So my first reaction was, what happened? Why isn't she at work? Like, she's a very responsible person. She wouldn't just miss work or not even call in. You know, she would call her sergeant.
A number of volunteers donated their time to help assist in the search for Kelly. They trudged through the surrounding woodland and handed out missing person posters, which described Kelly as standing at around 5 feet tall and weighing around 100 pounds. The first point of action was to retrace Kelly's steps. Investigators quickly discovered that Kelly was last seen leaving the Froggy Bottoms Bar on Ramsey Street in Fayetteville at around 1:20 a.m. on the 14th of April. She had been wearing a pink tube top with spaghetti straps and black shorts. As it would quickly be discovered, Kelly had been given a lift home from the bar by 25-year-old Nicholas Holbert, who was a regular at the bar. The owner said that Nicholas came into the bar quite frequently to play pool, and that he never drank alcohol. According to Nicholas, as he approached Kelly's apartment, she seemingly became nervous or afraid and asked him to pull up down the street and not outside the apartment. He said, I figured she didn't want me to know where she lived or somebody was there and she didn't want to be seen together. Kelly had sent a text message to her sister saying, got home safely. Investigators were quick to announce that they feared that Kelly may have been in danger, and an anonymous tip line was implemented. In fact, a number of the locals had also thought the worst. In 2008 alone, three female soldiers had been murdered, and in those three cases, either the victim's husband or the victim's husband and a friend had been responsible.
You said yesterday she may be in danger at the time. Do you believe she's still in danger?
Well, it's just the fact that no one has heard from us. The information we've received from her unit in command at Fort Bragg, very good soldier, not the type of person that would come up being AWOL or missing. So, and the fact that no one has heard from her since.
Very early on in the investigation, investigators were focusing on searching the area along Ramsey Street between Interstate 295 and Froggy Bottoms Bar. A helicopter hovered around the Carver's Fall area just off Ramsey Street while the searchers scoured the thick wooded area. The search soon enough shifted to a pond on private property, just off Dobbins Homes Road, which was approximately 12 miles away from the bar where Kelly had last been seen. According to investigators, a tip had led them to the pond. However, the following day, the search of the pond was called off, and investigators announced that they had found nothing. It would quickly be uncovered that Nicholas the last person seen with Kelly, had a criminal record. In 2003, when Nicholas was 16 years old, he was convicted of indecent liberties with a 5-year-old child. He had also been convicted of felony child abuse with serious bodily injury. Furthermore, Nicholas had essentially been homeless and had been living in a tent behind the bar. In fact, after it was reported that he had been the last person to see Kelly, he handed himself in to police on violation of his sex offender status, which had required him to provide a new address within 10 days of moving. Kelly's mother, Joanna Hansen, spoke with CBS and said that something wasn't quite adding up with Nicholas's story. She said, "I don't think she got home from the bar, and supposedly the person who dropped her off, something supposedly spooked her in the car, and he told them one time that she didn't want to get out of the car, yet she got out of the car, and that's the part I don't understand. If something spooked her, why would she get out of the car and, you know, go forward?" Joanna said that she had never heard Kelly speaking about Nicholas in the past, and as far as she was aware, they weren't friends. So why would he be giving her a lift home, she wondered. Speaking about the text message that had been sent from Kelly's phone that night, saying that she had got home safely, Joanna said that she didn't believe in her heart the text message had actually come from Kelly. Kelly's brother and sister spoke with 48 News and shared their belief that Nicholas was somehow involved.
Right off the bat, we knew Nicholas Hulbert was lying.
I never thought it was anything but he did it. I mean,
he did something.
You know what I mean? I never thought anything other than this is the guy, especially once you heard about his history and he's already a convicted sex offender. It's just,
Kelly's entire family had flown out to North Carolina from Florida to help assist in the search. Kelly was the youngest of the children in the family, and Joanna was completely beside herself with her daughter being missing. Kelly's brother Matt spoke with the media and said that he would continue to do so to keep the case fresh in everybody's mind. He said, "There's no doubt in my mind that we're going to find her alive. We expect to find her." Within days, the search team had swelled to well over several hundred. Investigators utilized the volunteers and broke them up into groups. They were all told to meet at 9 a.m. at a command post in the parking lot of Cape Fear Valley Health System's Health Pavilion North, and were asked to bring a valid photo identification. From here, investigators assigned the teams to different parts of North Fayetteville. The searchers had come out in droves. A number of them had brought along their horses or dogs to assist in the search. They weren't just looking for Kelly, but looking for any kind of clues which could lead to Kelly or help explain where she had gone. They said that if they found any evidence, for example Kelly's clothing, to not touch it. The command post had been set up at that specific area because it was here where Kelly's mobile phone last pinged before it was switched off. Her mobile phone had not yet been recovered, and the area was located around a half mile away from Kelly's apartment, and essentially right across the street from the Froggy Bottoms bar. While Nicholas was quite a suspicious person based on his history, investigators announced that he was a person with information, but not a suspect. They said that Nicholas had come forward on his own accord and had denied any involvement in Kelly's disappearance. They additionally said that there were a number of witnesses who had seen Nicholas leaving the bar with Kelly that night, but said that he had returned in less than 10 minutes. While investigators had already spoken to a handful of patrons in the bar that night, they announced that they were still wanting to speak to more, and asked anybody who had been at the bar that night to come forward and get in contact with them. The following week, there was an update in the case when Stephen Cantrell, the owner of the bar where Kelly was last seen, was arrested. However, police were quick to say that his arrest had no relation to Kelly's disappearance. As it turned out, Stephen had outstanding warrants and was arrested for failing to appear in court on a DWI charge and for failing to pay $400,000 worth of child support to three different women. Kelly's husband, Mike, appeared on the Today Show shortly thereafter, where he said that he was suspicious of Nicholas. During the interview, Mike said that there had been no new leads or tips in the case, or at least none that had been divulged to him. He said that Kelly was a very responsible person and said that the situation that Nicholas had described of him driving her home was fishy to him from the very beginning. Furthermore, he said that he didn't believe the text message had actually come from Kelly. As he said, there's no way. As a matter of fact, Mike said that he didn't even know why she was at the bar that night. A lot of suspicion had fallen onto Mike, because as it turned out, he and Kelly had been in the process of separating, but they had remained very close friends, and the separation had been mutual and had not been marred by any negative allegations from either side. Mike had been extremely proactive in the search for Kelly, and took part in the search every single day. As if it wasn't hard enough for her to have gone missing, he had to deal with baseless rumours surrounding their relationship. It would soon be discovered that Nicholas and Kelly weren't exactly strangers. In fact, Nicholas had picked Kelly up from her home that evening and taken her to the bar. At first, many thought that they had been strangers and that he simply offered her a ride home because she was drunk. However, this seemingly wasn't the case. Despite this, investigators had been able to essentially trace Kelly's evening at the bar through other patrons as well as phone records and text messages. There is nothing to indicate that something had been amiss that night. By all appearances, Kelly had a pretty ordinary night at the bar. The more time that elapsed, the more hope began to wane that Kelly would be found alive. After the first 72 hours, it gets much more difficult to locate a missing person, especially a missing adult. Fayette Police Detective Jeff Locklear admitted that the extensive searches had done little to offer any insight into Kelly's disappearance. He stated, "It's a frustrating investigation. It's tough." Hoping that it would generate more leads, Sparky Edwards, the owner of a security service based in Virginia, put forward an $8,000 reward for information that could assist in the search for Kelly. Sparky had been at Fort Bragg before being discharged after being wounded in Iraq. He also had a number of friends that were on the same unit as Kelly. On the 11th of May, a candlelight vigil was held for Kelly at the offices of the River Community Church. Mindy Wilson, who had helped organize the vigil, said, "We just want to keep a hope point for Kelly. We're not going to give up until we find her." The candlelight vigil was called a community celebration of hope, and a number of Kelly's loved ones showed up in support. Choking back tears, Mike said, "I just want her home and I want her safe. That's all I want." They all lit candles and prayed that Kelly would be found alive and well. At the end of the vigil, the organizers said that they would continue to search for Kelly until she was found. The following day, a similar vigil was held in St. Clouds Lakefront Park, which was where Kelly had been brought up. A number of her lifelong friends spoke fondly about Kelly. Tamara Collins said that Kelly would have done anything for her friends and family. They handed out missing person flyers which contained a phone number for tips, as well as a photograph of Kelly. By this point, Kelly's family had returned to Florida and said that they were still holding out hope that Kelly would be found. Towards the end of May, there was a disheartening update when it was announced that the body of a white woman had been discovered floating in the Cape Fear River. The area was located around 1.5 miles east of downtown Fayetteville. Locals were on edge as they awaited the results of the autopsy and waited for an identification to be made. However, it would turn out that the body was not Kelly. The body was that of 30-year-old Heather Nicole Smith. It would later be uncovered that Heather had been strangled to death by her boyfriend, Michael Overby, and there was no connection to the disappearance of Kelly. As the weeks turned to months, the volunteer searchers refused to give up. Each week, hundreds of people were still partaking in the search for Kelly. By this point, they had felt as though they had searched everywhere and were often retracing their own steps and keeping an eye out for any evidence associated with Kelly's disappearance or even any evidence of freshly dug holes. As one volunteer who didn't know Kelly said, "If it were me, I would want somebody to keep looking for me, and it's a fellow soldier. You shouldn't leave them. You shouldn't give up." Podcorn are revolutionising podcast sponsorships and connecting unique voices to unique brands. I'm lucky enough that Podcorn has sponsored this episode of Morbidology. There was once a time when only the big popular podcasts received sponsorships. Both Podcorn, indie podcasts like Morbidology, are able to work with amazing brands on their podcast and earn some cash for their work. Podcorn truly takes the confusion and stress out of finding sponsorships for your podcast or finding a podcast to sponsor your brand. It is a simple and straightforward way for brands and podcasters to connect and either earn money for your podcast or advertise your brand. All you need to do is sign up for free and begin browsing Podcorn's marketplace. The marketplace is super easy to use and has a handy calendar to take the stress out of booking multiple sponsors. One of the best things about Podcorn is that you have complete control over your spend as a brand or your price as a podcaster. You can charge whatever you want so you aren't constrained by the industry standard. Podcorn is an amazing way to connect podcasters to sponsorship opportunities, including host-read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and more. So click the link in my show notes to sign up to Podcorn today. There was no real update in the case until the 21st of November, when it was announced that remains had been discovered near Fort Bragg. However, shortly thereafter, Kelly's family let out a collective sigh of relief when it was determined that the remains belonged to an animal, not a human. With Christmas fast approaching, Kelly's family spoke with the media and said that they were hoping for a Christmas miracle. Over 7 months had passed and there was still no sign of Kelly. Her sister, Olivia Cox, said, "We're not searching for remains. We want Kelly back. We want her laughing, smiling, carrying on, her jubilant self to be here for Christmas and her birthday." Olivia revealed that on the night that Kelly vanished, she had sent her a text message saying that she was on her way home. Then 40 minutes later, she received another text message from her saying that she was home safely. Olivia stated that she did not believe that the second text message was from her sister. As she said, Kelly lived less than a mile away from the bar. Why did it take her 40 minutes to get home? Around the same time, Detective Jeff Locklear, who had interviewed Nicholas twice, said that he believed that Kelly had indeed accepted the ride from Nicholas, but said that he did not believe Nicholas's claims that Kelly had asked to be dropped off down the road from her apartment. For the first time in the investigation, he admitted, "He's not being upfront with us. I believe that Nick Holbert knows more than what he's saying and holds the key to what happened to Kelly." He further revealed that in the 7 months since Kelly's disappearance, there had been no electronic trace of her. She had not used her phone or her bank card and had not been in contact with any friends or family. Things weren't looking good. Detective Locklear said, "I try to stay away from saying a person is dead because there's no evidence, body or crime scene. But at this point, the chances of her being found alive would be slim." As the one-year anniversary was fast approaching, Fort Bragg and Fayetteville officials announced a $25,000 reward for information that could lead to the whereabouts of Kelly. Meanwhile, Fort Bragg's 601st Area Support Medical Company held a remembrance ceremony. Major Dan Reynolds said that the message in hosting the event was one of hope, that Kelly lived on in their hearts. The following month, the US Army declared Kelly legally dead. The change of status is standard procedure. After 1 year of a soldier being missing, the case is reviewed and a board makes a decision on how to reclassify the case. This move allowed Kelly's family to receive military death benefits. As her sister said, it's a technicality on some paperwork for the military more than it is a final answer for me and my family. They said that they weren't giving up on the search for Kelly and were still clinging to the hope that she was alive and well. After the army pronounced Kelly dead, the search for her was renewed. Then in November of that year, skeletal remains were discovered along railroad tracks in Fayetteville. A man had been walking along the tracks located in the area of Winslow Street and Southern Avenue when he came across a grim scene. He immediately informed police and the remains were sent to the North Carolina Medical Examiner's Office to determine the gender of the person, a possible cause of death, and hopefully an identification. The remains had been partially scattered and no clothing was found alongside them. The area wasn't secluded. In fact, it was quite central. The following week, the results were back and it had been determined that the body was not Kelly. It was 39-year-old Marcia Thompson, who had vanished 2 months earlier. The months slowly dragged by, and soon enough, the 2-year anniversary of Kelly's disappearance rolled around. The $25,000 reward was still in place, and the Find Kelly Bordeaux's Facebook page was still active. A lot of people in the area still conducted searches for Kelly, and her mother was still in constant contact with the Fayetteville police. Then in May of 2014, there was a grim update in the case. It was announced that the remains of Kelly had been discovered in a wooded area around 1 mile north of Interstate 296 on River Road in Fayetteville, and that Nicholas Holbert had been charged with first-degree murder. The area where her body had been discovered was around 4 miles away from the Froggy Bottom Bar. According to Police Chief Harold Medlock, Nicholas had led investigators to Kelly's body and had confessed to murdering her. He further said that they believed that Kelly had already been deceased when placed in the wooded area. Following the tragic update, Kelly's sister, Olivia, said, "I'm glad that justice is going to be served and glad that there's some resolve in this case." The following day, Nicholas appeared in court, where he was given a court-appointed lawyer. According to the arrest warrant, after Nicholas and Kelly left the bar that night, they had an argument in the parking lot before Nicholas knocked Kelly unconscious. He put Kelly in his car and drove her to the campsite that he had set up behind the bar. Here, he hit her several more times in the head, killing her. As news of the discovery wended throughout Fayetteville, many people were crushed. Hundreds of people had partaken in the search for months on end. The location where Kelly's body had been found became a makeshift memorial. Al McNathy, who had been one of the searchers, said that he visited the site just to see the end of a long search. A number of other searchers said that they went to the site on behalf of all the searchers who refused to give up in the search for Kelly. Misty Nolan said, "I needed to tell her goodbye and tell her I'm sorry that we couldn't find her sooner." As it would soon be discovered, the case had been cracked wide open by a private investigator, David Mashburn, who had spent the past 2 years working on the case. Around 5 months prior, Detective Mashburn had started working with Dr. Maurice Goodwin, a forensic consultant. In early October, he visited Nicholas at his home on Stewart Street. As he said, "You've got to know how to read someone and approach someone." When he knocked on the front door, he told Nicholas that he was not a law enforcement agent and that he did not work with law enforcement. He informed Nicholas that he was a private investigator. Over time, he and Nicholas spoke quite frequently, and he described the building of the relationship as delicate. He said that he often picked Nicholas up for food, coffee, or work, and gave him odd jobs to carry out for a bit of cash.
Well, the guy was down on his luck. He needed money. And if I gave him money, he would keep wanting to see me, whether I talked to him about Kelly or not. I mean, there were some times where I would be eating dinner with my family. He'd call and say, "I don't have anything. I need some cigarettes. I need to eat." And I'd drop what I was doing, leave my family, and go an hour away just to give him some money.
He described Nicholas as a loner and said that he had a childlike demeanor and that his personality did not match up with his conviction as a sex offender. He said that he frequently asked Nicholas if he was ready to talk. And then on the Monday, he took him to the Froggy Bottoms parking lot, where Nicholas made a full confession.
Yeah, I mean, went and picked her up, went back to the bar, you know, I mean, played pool, drink, sung karaoke, you know, everything was going good. Then I reckon somebody had told her about my sex offense thing, and I mean, I kind of, I didn't know it, but I mean, that's when she started acting kind of funny towards me. Then, you know, when she said she was ready to go home, you know, I was talking with her, and I mean, I can't remember exactly what was said, but I know she said to me, she said, "Not you, child molester," or something like that. And I just snapped and zoned out and hit her, knocked her out. And I stuck her in the car and took her back to where I stayed at. And then she woke up, started screaming, and I hit her again, knocked her out again. And I mean, I can't really remember what happened in that time period. I know, you know, I mean she was dead then that morning, or I reckon it was like 4:35 or something. And I stuck her in the car and took her down here.
Then what?
She was kind of like disoriented and she started screaming real loud. And, you know, I got scared. I didn't want nobody to hear her, so I hit her again.
Are you hitting her with your fist?
Yeah.
Okay. Did she have a bloody nose, bloody mouth, anything like that?
It was dark back there.
Okay. And then that's when you loaded up and come down here. How do you know this spot?
I didn't. I just driving and seeing it.
So you ain't never been here before? You didn't like deer hunting or nothing? Okay. And then you dug the hole back here, put her in the hole. When we get the body up out of there, tell me what I'm going to find. Did you put anything in the hole?
I think it's like a white trash bag.
What's in it?
Nothing. Empty.
Okay.
And maybe a shirt or something I found at the bar.
Okay. And the shovel that you used, where'd you get it from?
From the barn.
Okay.
According to Detective Mashburn, the confession was a relief for Nicholas. On the 28th of May, Fort Bragg held a memorial service for Kelly, during which fellow soldiers spoke fondly about Kelly. They spoke of her uplifting and outgoing personality as well as her 1,000-watt smile. They said that when she came in for personal training, she always ended up making everybody laugh, even though they were all dreading the session. Her battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Heather Nees, said, "Kelly Bordeaux was an amazing woman who brought the entire community of Fayetteville and beyond together, and she gave us all a special kind of hope. Hope for her return home. Hope that her family could find peace among the unknowing, and hope that we could all live life just as she did. There was a very somber moment when there was a mock roll call during the memorial. Kelly's name was called out, and there was no response. Her name was called out a second time, and once again, silence. A third call also went unanswered. It was followed by a gun salute and the playing of taps. The soldiers then saluted Kelly at the battlefield cross at the front of the All-American Chapel. The cross included boots, a helmet, and dog tags, with Kelly's name emblazoned on the front. On the 1st of June, Kelly was finally laid to rest in her hometown of St. Cloud. Dozens of people clambered into Cornerstone Church to say their final goodbyes. During the service, her family spoke of her drive to succeed and her desire to help people. Her friends said that she was always accepting of everybody, and despite her small size, she had a massive heart. She was subsequently buried in Mount Peace Cemetery. Her mother Joanna accepted an American flag from a soldier as a tribute to Kelly's services.
One bad person took Kelly away from us, but so many more people, hundreds of people, strangers, came out and supported somebody they might not even know. She was an aunt, she was a soldier, she was somebody.
Kelly's cause of death would be determined to be blunt force trauma to the head. According to the state chief medical examiner, her autopsy corroborated what Nicholas had confessed to. It appeared as though Kelly had been punched once in the face and then hit over the head several times with some kind of heavy object. Disturbingly, when Kelly's body was taken for an autopsy, it was discovered that not all of her remains had been recovered. Despite this, Fayetteville police did not go out to the area where she had been found for another search. It would be Detective Mashburn, the private investigator, who would recover the rest of Kelly's remains. Her mother Joanna said, "I tried to tell them at the autopsy that I don't have all of her. Would you want your daughter lying in the dirt?" Detective Mashburn had been able to recover bones that had come from Kelly's fingers and toes, as well as her fingernails. He also recovered bones from Kelly's neck. Joanna lambasted the police, stating, "The police didn't do their job. David did their job." Detective Mashburn had truly put his all into solving the case. It not only took a toll on his personal life, but his mental health as well. As he would later say to 48 Hours, "I almost lost everything I had on this case. Money, my family, and my sanity. But I'm proud to be who I am and what I did for Kelly and her family." In fact, Detective Mashburn hadn't actually been hired by anybody. He worked on the case out of his own pocket, but he was determined because he knew deep down that Nicholas was involved, and he refused to give up. In early August, Nicholas pleaded guilty to first-degree murder. As part of the plea agreement that he had reached, the death penalty was taken off the table, and he received an automatic life sentence without the possibility of parole. During the court hearing, it was revealed that at the time, Kelly and Mike had separated, and Kelly had been dating another man named Justin Thompson, who was out of town that night. That evening, Nicholas picked Kelly up at her apartment and took her to Froggy Bottoms. Justin had actually been with Kelly when they first met Nicholas. He told 48 Hours that he thought that Nicholas was a bit odd.
But Nick had like introduced himself, so that's how he got in. He kept wanting to play pool. We did the same thing the next night. You know, we just drank, and he always wanted to be around. He always wanted to hang out. I'd always catch him staring at her. I told her, I was like, "That guy is creepy, man. I don't know the kid that much to say that he's going to be dangerous. I just knew he was different. I knew I didn't want to hang out with him." But she was nicer than that. She's accepting of everybody. You know, she just invited everybody in her life. Next week that he actually gets to hang out with her, he goes crazy. Like, I just thought he wouldn't leave her alone, you know, like he'd be harassing and stuff.
That night, when Kelly was alone with Nicholas, she discovered that he was on the sex offender registry. She sent a text message to Justin that she was getting a lift home with Nicholas, but said that she was a little bit concerned since she had just learned of his past.
He was supposed to be her ride home. And I told her she should be picked up like a little around the corner and be dropped off, like not exactly in front of her door, but don't know where your exact apartment is. She was texting me out throughout the night. And at the end of the night, she texted, like, call me. And then I got a text after that that said, I'm home now. Everything's fine. I'll call you tomorrow. So I call her and her phone's off. That's when I started to, like, really panic. I already knew it. I knew it from the beginning. This guy was too creepy. To him have done something. I already had a feeling about him. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why I felt like that. I just did. I just knew. That's the only creepy person she got encountered with. And then he says he dropped her off.
While in the car park, Nicholas had asked Kelly if she would be willing to spend more time with him. But she said no and confronted him about his past. He punched Kelly in the face, knocking her unconscious, and then took her back to his campsite. Here, Kelly woke up and she started to scream. Nicholas then beat Kelly to death with some kind of object, most likely a rock. He then sent a text message from Kelly's phone saying that she had got home safely and that she was going to bed. He then drove to a convenience store for gas and then buried Kelly's body in a shallow grave. 2 years later, he would reveal where that grave was. In court, Nicholas was given the opportunity to speak. He said, I realize there isn't anything I can say or do to ease the pain and suffering that you have endured because of my actions. Before he apologized, the judge ordered Kelly's brother, Matt, out of the courtroom because he was about to attack Nicholas. Later, he said that he saw it as a blessing in disguise and that if he stayed in that courtroom any longer, he would have ended up lashing out at Nicholas.
I figured I would just assault him, actually. That's honestly what I thought would happen, is I would just assault him. So it was a good thing that the judge kicked me out.
Kelly's mother, Joanna, provided a victim impact statement.
Mr. Hobart, could you look at me for a minute? Please. I don't understand how you could take a beautiful young girl for pretty much no reason and beat the life right out of her.
Kelly was a decent person. She didn't judge people unfairly. I wish she had found out what type of person Holbert was earlier. I don't understand how you could take a beautiful young girl for pretty much no reason and beat her with your fists and rocks, and then bury her in the woods like a dog. Would you forgive someone like that? Is your heart big enough for that? You, Mr. Holbert, I hate. You took my grandchildren from me. You took my baby girl, and for nothing. And you want to say sorry?
We never gave up on her, and I love her more than anything. And that bringing her home was something I promised her I would do. And I would never let her down. I wanted her to come back smiling and laughing and hugging and to get to meet the new members of our family and to continue to experience so much in life. She had so much to offer.
The disappearance of Kelly Bordeaux completely galvanized Fort Bragg and the surrounding area. For days on end, hundreds of people showed up to assist in the search for the young soldier. When Kelly vanished, she was just starting out what she hoped would be a long and successful career in the military. But on that fateful night, a local sex offender had different plans. Unable to escape his past and accept responsibility for what he had done, Nicholas Holbert made a decision that night to snuff out Kelly's bright future. Although some semblance of closure was achieved for Kelly's tight-knit family when he pleaded guilty, he left a wound that will never truly heal. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big, massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, Tanya Ackerman, Angel Wingfield, and Ricardo Higuereda. The support on Patreon helps to defray the costs of freedom of information requests, archive subscriptions, hosting, and much more. Morbidology wouldn't be what it is without the help of my lovely Patreons. If you join me on Patreon, you get monthly exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, where they release episodes, ad-free episodes, true crime articles, and you can request a case for me to cover on Morbidology. You can also sign up annually and get 15% off. Big thank you to everybody who has simply listened to an episode, commented on an episode, shared an episode, left a review. All of the support is very much appreciated. If you didn't know already, I have a new investigative true crime series coming out on the 23rd of November. It's called The Shattered Window and uncovers an unsolved murder as well as a wrongful conviction. Please make sure to subscribe to The Shattered Window wherever you're listening. Can I also ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a show that you like. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.